This episode is brought to you by Churchwide Ornamentation and Ammunition Incorporated. Since the Democrats are stealing the election, and it's only a matter of time before those snowflakes confiscate your guns and deny your Second Amendment rights, it's time for every red-blooded Christian American to praise God and pass the ammunition. Churchwide Ornamentation and Ammunition Incorporated has just what any true Christian congregation needs to worship the Prince of Peace this Christmas season and protect your family from the coming socialist overlords. Our brand new cross of guns is suitable for hanging right behind the altar of any congregation. We will take your choice of guns, either pistols and or long guns, and tastefully arrange them into a cross to enhance your worship of God. Our crosses of guns come in several sizes, suitable for any size congregation. Try our 18-inch by 40-inch model. It's made of two Glock pistols for the crossbeam and two AR-15s as the vertical piece. Or, for larger congregations, how about our 80-inch by 120-inch model? It comes with two AK-47 rifles as the cross piece, and your choice of two pistols and two long guns for the vertical piece. Megachurches may want to look at our extreme model. It's made out of two rocket-propelled grenade launchers for the crossbeam and as many sniper's rifles as it takes for the vertical piece. All of our crosses of guns are made with real guns. Make sure to check out our silver or gold plating options to make them nice and pretty. Remember that Jesus died for your sins, so those liberals have to pry your guns from your cold, dead hands. Worship the Prince of Peace this Christmas with crosses of guns made by Churchwide Ornamentation and Ammunition Incorporated. Hey there, Save Me Podcast listeners. Man, a lot has happened since I last spoke with you a few weeks back. Donald Trump lost the election. I don't know about you, but I was addicted to watching the vote totals in swing states that were not called on election night. I am grateful for every freaking one of those mail-in voters in Pennsylvania, Georgia, and Nevada. I've noticed that I don't feel particularly elated at Trump's loss, just a deep sense of weariness. I'm really not sure how I would have made it for another 4 years under Trump. The thought of it just seems too awful to consider. The current popular word for people like me, I guess, is empath. I guess I am one. I don't know how you test for that, but it seems to suit me. And for me, the last 4 years have just been brutal. Every day, the lying and abuse and name-calling, it has hurt me almost physically. My soul hurts from it. When the media begins each morning with whatever Trump tweeted out from his sick mind, the abuse, the lies, and then that would just recycle all day long, and I got to the point long ago of trying to shut out the news, but no matter how hard I tried, I couldn't totally shut it out. And it would inevitably get inside my brain. And man, I am just so tired of the meanness, the blatant corruption, the hypocrisy, the narcissism. I just feel weary of it all. I know this last-ditch effort by Trump to save face with his lawsuits and resisting the transition of administrations, it's going to end one way or the other by January 20th. So I'm not too worried about that stuff. It's the other stuff that is still wearing on me. My kids' school system just literally announced minutes ago that they are going back to full-time remote classes after about a month and a half of hybrid, and my kids going to school at least 2 days a week. COVID cases and hospitalizations are skyrocketing in Metro Kansas City, where I live, and we are definitely going back to previous lockdown measures. I haven't seen my elderly father in a few weeks, and even then, that was when I took him to a doctor's appointment because the retirement community he lives in is on full lockdown. I just know winter is going to be brutal with COVID as we all just wait for the vaccines to come. And I know so many people have it worse than I do. Our society has so much work to do to come back from the devastation of the virus, this economic collapse caused by it, and just the last 4 years of awfulness. And I wish I had faith in our country that we have it in us to come back from all this. But from my perspective, when half the country votes for a racist, fascist, corrupt excuse for a human being, I just don't know if we've got it in us to come back from all this. And so, as I'm saying these words to you, whoever you are, I realize how much I've got to take care of myself and how much you probably need to take care of yourself, because things aren't just going to get better anytime soon. We've got another marathon to run emotionally and spiritually, and it doesn't matter at all that we've just finished running one already. At the church where I'm serving right now as interim pastor, as I still try to figure out what's in the future for me, it's somewhat belated stewardship time. For non-church folks, let me explain what stewardship time means. Think the pledge time offered by your local public radio station, only done really badly by most churches. It is the fundraising time for the coming next year's budget, where church folks pledge money for the next year, and hopefully they don't get pissed off and leave and not turn in their money, but you can never predict that. It is my absolute worst time of the year to preach before a congregation. I hate talking about money in this way. The mistakes you can make as minister are numerous, and even if you don't make one, you never know who's going to get turned off or pissed off by something you say about money. It's such a personal thing, and it's not like religious institutions have ever had a good track record of dealing with money, so it's an uphill slog. And in the role of a minister, at least in the kind of churches I'm in, it's absurd, really, having to be up front preaching and teaching about money. Jesus talked about it a lot, and I think having the right kind of attitude towards materialism is essential for being a Christian or just a healthy person of any faith or no faith. But when you're salary is paid for by a church and the income to that church is overwhelmingly what people in the pews listening to you preach give to the church, well, it is literally singing for your supper, no matter how you spiritually package it. And I don't know a minister who enjoys it at all. Maybe there are a few weird ones out there who say it's a joy to talk about money and using it for the kingdom of God, but not me or anybody I know. So anyway, when I talk during this fundraising time, I try to talk about what churches should be and why they're an important investment. And I'm fully aware when I do it that most churches probably aren't a good investment and are not what they should be. They aren't places of safety and rest for people who are dying of thirst, people who don't even know they're dying of something. So one of the illustrations I roll out is one I picked up a few years ago from a daily email that goes out by the United Church of Christ, one of the denominations I'm in. This one was by Talitha Arnold. She's a United Church of Christ minister at a church in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And she writes the following about her church. She says, "A central mission of any church is to offer streams of living water, that connection with the living God. A local congregation is like a desert riparian zone. Those are the areas along a desert river that abound with life because they offer water, shade, and sustenance. Whether we're in the desert southwest or rain-drenched northwest, the world needs riparian faith communities where souls are renewed and the thirst for love and hope is quenched. Last summer, on my sabbatical, I went to just the area where Arnold serves as a minister. I stayed in a place not far from Santa Fe called the Ghost Ranch. I saw the arroyos, or creek beds. I feel like a poser rolling my R's. But anyway, I saw those creek beds where you can see the only things that are green out there in their desert, because that's the only place they can find moisture. And if you get up high enough, you can see these riverbeds or creek beds. They're like lines of green stretching out into the endless vista of brown deserts. Green lines stretching out into the horizon in the midst of all these various shades of brown. You know, life comes at you in so many ways, and it sucks dry your soul. You've got to find your riparian zones where you can find them. Or you dry up and you blow away because the life inside you is sucked dry. And I don't know who you are. I don't know why you're listening to my podcast. So I have no idea where or what your riparian zones are. Maybe you are fortunate enough to be a part of one of those rare faith communities that offers life to you rather than politics and drama and unhealthy family systems. Maybe it's the yoga studio, or maybe it's the corner bar. Maybe it's your family or your partner. Maybe it's being outdoors. Maybe it's binging on Netflix or doing whatever it is where you're living out your special calling and doing what only you love to do. I don't know where your desert riparian zone is, but I hope you find it. I hope you drink deeply in the life that you need these days. In today's episode, I finish up my conversation with Sonia Van. In previous episodes, we have been talking about Black Lives Matter after the killing of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery, and so many others this year. We've also talked about what happened in Ferguson and why St. Louis is such a racist city. Well, today's episode is the final one with Sonia. She and I talked about a lot of stuff, but today we're talking about her work in theological education. Sonia is the Director of Admissions and Financial Aid at Eden Theological Seminary in St. Louis, and she is on the boards of all kinds of organizations, church stuff, and otherwise. Sonia is an African-American. She prefers the word black. She's a bisexual woman as well. And so intersectionality is one of those things she lives with and has to negotiate in various parts of her identity. In addition to working at Eden Seminary, which is a part of the United Church of Christ, one of the historic mainline denominations that are quickly dying, that's the kind I serve in, she is also executive director at Pathways to Theological Education, which provides theological education that is progressive theologically for non-traditional students headed into ministry for whom seminary may not be an option. For non-clergy, you might be thinking this discussion about theological education doesn't matter. And for all I know, maybe it doesn't. Yet, theological education has transformed dramatically in recent decades from a predominantly residential experience of getting a master's degree for younger people starting out their careers to a predominantly online experience for second career students. Students who are coming in already with a lot of student debt and so paying a bunch of money to answer a call to serve in God in the church. Churches that also don't have any money is making it a pretty rough time. And so seminaries are closing. For instance, the seminary that I attended and got my Master's of Divinity is now closed due to lack of money. And just like many churches and denominations are dying, so are seminaries. And this really presents a problem for progressive Christian faith communities who value education. Who will train their clergy? And maybe that doesn't matter to you because you are not a church person. But if you are in higher ed or education at all, you can possibly relate to this experience, or maybe if you're in any field where technology and cultural trends have left your kind of work being too expensive and potentially obsolete to survive. Even if you aren't religious and you can't relate, if you care about politics in America, this conversation matters. If you have any hope for religious voices that are anything other than the Christian religious right, then you should care about what happens to moderate and progressive theological institutions. In the 20th century, they were the bastions of liberal theology that counterbalanced fundamentalism in America. In recent decades, we've seen that the money just keeps growing for the ignorant and intolerant forms of Christianity in America, and money is drying up for other points of view. And no matter whether or not you are a religious person, religion is never going to stop being a powerful force in American life, for good and for ill. If the only choices left are the religious right on the one side and atheism or agnosticism on the other side, then America is really never going to get better. It's only going to get worse. Things are going to get messier than they already are. And so I'd say that even if you are not a religious person at all, you should hope that there can be more voices that are religious and also respecting of science, open to pluralism, open to other religions than their own and people that don't claim any at all, others that care about democracy and care about people who are marginalized, because otherwise we're just going to get a religion that reinforces income inequality, destroying the environment, reinforcing gender stereotypes, and oppressing anybody who isn't a white male. But maybe our discussion about theological education may not matter to you, and if so, you can just skip it and wait until I get another episode out in a few weeks or sooner, hopefully. So anyway, don't forget to like the Save Me Podcast Facebook page. Follow us on Twitter at SaveMePodcast1. You can even listen on iTunes or Spotify, or you can listen to it on the site that helps me put this out, anchor.fm, like a boat anchor.fm. If you would like to support this podcast financially, I'd say first, give your money to somebody working for racial justice or some sort of cause that makes the world a better place. And then if you have change left over, you can sponsor the show by going to anchor.fm/save-me-podcast and clicking the sponsor button. I'm grateful to those who already do it. It helps me to keep going. I do enjoy doing this. It's meaningful to me, but it's hard to find time for it. And feeling like I've got people out there who are literally giving even a little bit towards it reminds me that it matters to somebody else and not just me. And so I keep doing it. You can share this podcast with anybody else you think you can handle it. Look, I know I'm an acquired taste. This podcast isn't for everyone, so be careful who you share it with. And please rate and review this podcast on whatever platform you're using. Apparently that helps people find it. And when people find it and more people listen, I'm more likely to put it out and do it more often. I think it's good for me and my soul because I don't know what the hell I'm doing in my life right now still. And this is an outlet for me. And if it's meaningful for you, that's how I know it. And that gives me meaning too. So don't forget, send your roots deep down into your desert riparian zone. I will try to do the same in the coming days. Just a reminder in case you needed it. I don't know much of anything. And if you're listening to this podcast, hoping you will find somebody or something to save you, do not look at me. I'm looking for somebody to save me too. This podcast is brought to you by gift card advent calendars. In past Christmas seasons, you may have noticed advent calendars that give a child a new toy each day, such as Legos. Gone are the days when you could get by with an advent calendar that just gave your child a Bible verse to read or a piece of chocolate each day of Advent. You, as a Christian parent, need to up your game if you want your son or daughter to avoid the fires of hell. That's why this year, gift card advent calendars are here. Jesus said you can't worship God and mammon, but that was before gift cards were invented. Each day of Advent, your kid will open the door on that day's prize to find a different gift card from a major retailer like Target, Walmart, Old Navy, or Costco. After all, Jesus said, "Lay up your treasures in heaven." But we don't read about the baby Jesus turning his nose up at the gold, frankincense, and myrrh that the wise men gave him. Am I right? On some days in your kid's gift card advent calendar, your child will find a gift card to their favorite online games. What better way to remember Jesus is the reason for the season than by buying expensive new outfits for their online avatars that are just bits of data floating in a server somewhere that aren't even in the real material world? You don't want them to be the worst-dressed players on their video game circuit, do you? The season of Advent lasts from 22 to 28 days a year, so each of our gift card Advent calendars goes for the full 28. And each day's gift card is at least $25. So that adds up to the low, low cost of, well, a lot of money for each Advent calendar. But before you say that's too much to pay to share the love of Jesus Christ with your child, remember, Jesus said, "Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." So rest assured, your kids will treasure their gift card advent calendars, and their hearts will be sure to remember that their gift cards came because of a Merry Christmas and not because of some generalized pagan happy holidays. Gift card advent calendars available at most major retailers and giftcardadventcalendars.com.
I'm going to switch topic dramatically, okay? And I'm going to talk about theological higher education. I don't know how free you feel like you can speak, but and anything you say and you don't want me to include, I will not include. Mm-hmm. Theological education is changing because the church is declining so fast in mainline denominations, but maybe everywhere. to me, it feels like a watershed moment where it used to be if you had your MDiv, you could count on getting a full-time job in a church somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's almost to the point where you can't count on that anymore. I think pretty soon, 5-10 years, you're going to be losing enough older members that the money is going to be gone. And the church is changing. And it's and the schools have already changed so much of moving from would go to seminary and you'd live there like college and to being commuters to now being online. Theological education is changing so dramatically. I mean, what do you see when you're talking with prospective students and they're talking with you about this calling they have? What conversations are going on about you may make this sacrifice, but on the other side of this, you may not have some full-time job with benefits waiting for you anymore.
Right.
Is that conversation going on?
To be honest with you, I think it's very much a reason why I was promoted to this position for late. Prior to me becoming the director of admissions at Eden, I was a part of the Economic Challenges Facing Future Ministers Lilly grant that we received at Eden. Mm-hmm. And so what that grant really did was look at what the outcomes were for people who graduated from seminary and the indebtedness and the livelihood and their resilience, right, as they started to look at their economic challenges. And so what I found in another part of this is that I also worked for over 20 years in financial aid with several servicers and everything, and was very much a part of the direct lending, the move to direct lending as a lobbyist. I have a lot of background in it, and what I'm finding right now is that seminaries themselves were originally set up to be, when they went to being a bachelorette to a graduate program, were supposed to be on the equivalency of a JD and an MD, right?
Right.
And so you would get an MDiv, and that would be the divinity's equivalent to having a postgraduate degree in law and medicine. But the difference between all three of them is that you could go into law and you could go into medicine, and you could triple, double, quadruple your income from what it was at the beginning. So I know right now that most residency people get paid about $40,000 in residency. They graduate from residency, and they go in and they end up with $150,000 right off the bat. And that's just in general medicine. That's an instant, that's real, and that's the reason why those years of training and that amount of money that's charged for that makes sense. Well, when you get into seminary training, it used to be where people could graduate, and depending on how good the school was that they graduated from, who they knew, and how great of a preacher they were, they could find themselves a really nice church. They could go there, they would have a parsonage that was paid for, and a 300, 400 plus denomination that paid them, you know, a good fair $50,000 salary, which was good money. What has happened is that as education has increased over the years, lack of support for seminary, which is a reflection of churches and the decline of actual organized mainline Protestant churches. And also, let me also say that Catholicism is feeling the same thing, and they actually felt it before we did, and Orthodox seminaries, and there are not as many rabbis as there used to be. So it's everybody's feeling it. Religion and institutional religion is in decline. So as that happened, then of course, congregations started to close and decline, and the average size of a congregation now is really about 60 people on a good day. Some of them are as small as 25, and some of them, yes, are big mega churches, but those are few and far between. Most congregations are 50, 60 people, maybe 100 at the most. And so these people have to now pay a pastor how much? $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a year. If they don't have an endowment, it's even harder. As they starting to age, it's even harder. As their community starts to decline and there's less people who want to actually come and be a part of them, it becomes much harder. And so now you're raising up a new generation of people who go into seminary, and the way that they get through seminary is by student loans. But student loans are based off of people graduating and then going out and exponentially increasing their income. Most people come to seminary and their income goes down once they graduate from seminary.
Yeah, that's right.
You have these loans, you have this economic challenge, and who make up the people that come back and give money back to the seminary? Well, traditionally, it was the people who graduated from seminary that had these nice churches. It was the landowners that benefited from these wonderful pastors that helped guide their life and raise their children, right? But these people aren't there anymore. And the people who are coming to us now are more predominantly poor. They already have a whole lot of debt because that's part of what the system is under in undergrad. They're older, so they've actually acquired even more debt, right?
Yeah.
Many of them are not going into congregations to work full time. They're going into congregations that have half time, three quarters time, but they want all your full time.
Right. Yeah.
They're
yeah.
in half time, but they want your full time.
That's
and
right.
And then some.
You're on call all the time.
Yes, all the time, which, just think about it, that's a doctor, and yes. doctors get paid well for that. And so here we are looking at the situation, and the cost of tuition is steadily going up. Then what really did us seminaries, gave us a hard time, was the decision by many of the mainline Protestant denominations to not require an MDiv.
Yeah.
So we already know that the United Church of Christ is in the middle of that conversation right now, and it's actually due to be part of the vote, although I haven't seen it come down yet in the paperwork in our General Synod. When that goes through, that's a huge shift. And yeah. we've already seen several of the seminaries shut down because of all that other stuff I mentioned. This is going to be another shift. And what we haven't spoken about is the fact that in the midst of all of this going on, so Eden Theological Seminary is now closed because, and we closed in the middle of March, COVID-19. And Eden Seminary is one of those contexts that says, come to this wonderful campus, and it's a beautiful campus, don't get me wrong,
yeah.
and be a part of who we are because we're so heavily context-based.
Yep.
And we've had to make that shift, and that shift has not been easy for us. Now, we're doing well, right, because we can use Zoom. Technology has helped us quite a bit. We can use Zoom, and we can do all this other stuff, but it's difficult. And what we're finding now is that how to be in a conversation with students who are seeking a call, but let's be realistic about what the real benefit is financially after the call. So
yeah.
many people will have to go into non-for-profit work. They can be like me, right? So I wanted to work full-time for the church, but I understood what I was getting myself into. But at the same time, I also knew that I was probably going to have to be bivocational. So if I took on corporate America or corporate church, right, I was also going to have to take on probably a congregation as well. And I was okay with that. What I have found is I didn't have to do that. And I do a lot of board work now. I serve on a lot of boards. And so I find that I try to be honest with people as they come. I want to know, and I ask them, so what are your plans? Right? Because I'm also the admissions director and the financial aid director. I also talk to them about the real challenges facing them when they graduate. And so let's not borrow so much money. Let's go out and let's look at the grants that are available, the scholarships that are available. And then that's my external voice. My internal voice to Eden is, let's reduce the cost of tuition. Let's make this affordable for people. And I think that I would do a disservice to the church that I love, the denomination that I love, and the institution that I love if I don't have that conversation with them as well. I say that, and this is something you don't know, I have a part-time job that I do on the side. I'm the executive director of Pathways Theological Education Incorporated, and they're a completely online, non-accredited program of study that is a fraction of the cost. I think that the conversation that I have with people around that is that that's for people who are in rural community who don't have access or economic funding to take on and do a seminary education. There's a trade-off for both, right? You're rolling the dice, so to speak, to go to seminary because you really don't know what you're going to get when it's all said and done. And let me also say about my own personal walk is just because you go to seminary and you do really well, because I graduated top of my class with honors, you may not be ordained because I'm not ordained, right? And that's some oppression stuff in and of itself, but that's part of it, right? And then the other side of it is in communities where they can't afford to economically support their ministers, and they're so far removed where they can't even get internet connections on a regular stable internet connection. Sometimes it's easier for people to do a asynchronistic plan where they can dial in, do their education when they have the ability to do so, and then go back to their regular lives. I think that with the alternative paths that's coming down the line for us at this point, to have both of those is intention. It's very much intention for me right now, where we are. And there are some people who are going to need the MDiv because they're going to go on and do some other things, right? And there's some people who need to be able to serve their local ministry, but do it with some education and a good sound education that allows them to do that work. And I'm seeing different people doing it, choosing it different ways all over the place. But I think that my biggest conversation with them is economically, what can you afford? and what are your plans for the future, and do you have a path that you can imagine and envision that makes sense that's going to get you there?